Well, I'm glad you all came today, and it's good to be with you, and it's always valuable to show up at the house of the Lord if you're available and able. So, apparently you are. So last week we were working our way through chapter 30 of Isaiah, and Isaiah was looking ahead to a time whenever that God would bring he says here in verse 18, the Lord is waiting that he might be gracious unto you. He's wanting to be reunited in fellowship with the people. He's wanting to restore Jerusalem. He's wanting to right all the wrongs. But whenever the people are going a different direction, whenever they're serving idols, whenever they are not preserving justice for the widow and the poor, God can't do that. But he looks forward to a time when things will be different. He talks here about your oxen having and your donkeys having clean food, been double sifted, clear water, rivers and streams of water. Moreover, in verse 26, the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold. And so that, depending on your perspective there, that could be a good or bad thing, right? The sun's seven times hotter, thinking about temperature, is like, wow, I don't want to be outside when that happens. But if you think about light, oh, there's something about light. As you get older, you find that it's not just important that things be in focus. You got to have light, too, to see. And the more of it, the better. If you're trying to get the details, if you're trying to see exactly what's happening, it just is so important to have light. And I'm realizing, too, how important peripheral vision is to human beings. So that's something they always test you for. If you go to the eye doctor, right, they want to see if your peripheral vision is failing. But do you ever drop things? You ever had drop a screw, something small? You know what? I find that what I do is when I drop something, I immediately just go blanket, watch for movement, right? You're, with your eyesight, you're not focused on anything particular. Where do I see movement? That gives me a clue of where it is. Because you take a small screw in the sawdust or in the dirt, I mean, you're not going to find it unless you have some hint about where approximately it went. And so that minutest movement that your eye catches whenever you drop something small is so critical. But there again, if you don't have light, it's not going to work. And so this is looking at the light as something which is such an enabler for life. And of course, in the ancient world, you couldn't just flip on the LEDs whenever it got dark. If there wasn't light from the sun, light from the moon, you might have a fire with its shadows and flickering flame, but there's nothing to substitute for sunlight when it comes to seeing reality. And so he says, the moon shall be like the sun, and the sun shall be seven times brighter in the day that the Lord bindeth up the breach of his people and healeth the stroke of their wound. Behold, the name of the Lord cometh from afar, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue as a devouring fire. Now, we're going to read here in a minute a little bit from Kings to give us a little better insight into the history that Isaiah is living through. One of the things when you read down through here, it's kind of like you're on a bucking bronco or something. It's like, okay, which direction did Isaiah go now? There's so many streams of thought and so many different ways to focus on the world. Sometimes he's looking at what's going on now. Sometimes he's looking at the future. Sometimes he's telling this from one perspective, sometimes another. And so it gets to be a challenge just to read it in a vacuum. And sometimes it helps to look at the history. So one of the things that we've seen already in Isaiah is this huge issue of whether or not the Israelites find security in alliances with other people, in particular the Egyptians, against the Assyrians. And then, too, there's the whole issue of the Assyrians. They are a threat. Do you run and hide? Do you what? Well, Isaiah says you trust in the Lord. And now and then he gives us a little hint. Sometimes he shows the Assyrians, as it were, as the hand of God, bringing judgment to nations that have forsaken him. Other times he shows the Assyrians as nothing but a pawn in God's hands. That is, they too will be brought to an end. And so here he says, the name of the Lord cometh from afar, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue as a devouring fire. So this kind of device is called an anthropomorphism. It's where you describe the divine in the terms of the human. So it's not that God actually has lips or a tongue or these things, but it is a picture that we can relate to. We know what it looks like whenever somebody is very, very angry. We know the expressions on their face. We're familiar with the tongue that can lash you as a devouring fire. And so those are things that we can relate to. And so that's how he pictures the judgments of God here. His breath as an overflowing stream shall reach to the midst of the neck. Okay, that's about as deep as you want to go, I would say. To sift the nations with the sieve of vanity. And there shall be a bridle in the jaws of the people, causing them to err or to go out of the way, to go astray. Ye shall have a song, as in the night, when a holy solemnity is kept. For the Jews, the outstanding night festival would be Passover, where you eat the lamb of Passover in a night ceremony. And so it was a very hallowed and special time, a holy solemnity. You shall have a song and gladness of heart, as when one goeth with a pipe to come into the mountain of the Lord, to the mighty one of Israel. And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lighting down of his arm. Okay, so that's kind of an odd expression. There's some better translations of that. Let me scroll here so it shows them. So the ESV says the descending blow of his arm to be seen. Okay. That communicates pretty graphically. This he is from above, blow of his arm. In furious anger, bless you, and a flame of devouring fire with a cloudburst and storm and hailstones. These are all things which, as human beings, we can relate to as expressions of great power. The other night, we had a tornado siren go off here in Salem as an approaching storm front was coming, and Rachel and I were at S&S. We was looking out the window, and we started to see things move around, and and the wind blowing, and we're like, where should we go? What's something massive that won't move or that won't collapse? And so we got back between the forklift and the planer. Those are both pretty stout. I think even if the roof came down, they'd hold them up. Turned out it didn't amount to much. But I recognized from the signs I saw outside, you know, nature is capable of bringing it all down on top of you or taking it away. We build structures that seem pretty stout under normal conditions, but you change the conditions, and suddenly these structures, which seem like they would stand for a very long time, don't. They just can't withstand those particular forces. And, of course, it would be quite expensive to build something that would withstand everything the weather can throw at it time to time. So we usually don't. But anyway, these are pictures here of the awesome power of God that are vaguely represented by the forces of nature. So the strong arm, the fire, the tempest. For through the voice of the Lord shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. And that King James Version makes it sound like it is the Assyrian that did the smoting or the smiting. But most translations make that another reference to God. The Assyrians will be terror-stricken at the voice of the Lord when he strikes with his rod. In every place where the grounded staff shall pass, okay, and not grounded like electrically grounded, but the word refers to a foundation. And even then it's a little bit hard to envision that. So ESV translates it appointed, every stroke of the appointed staff that the Lord lays on them will be to the sound of tambourines and lyres. Battling with brandished arm, he will fight with them. Okay, so I spent quite a bit of time examining this one. I just didn't get the tambourines thing. And what that might be a reference to. And I kind of finally ended up with, you know, Isaiah here is portraying this, and we could probably best relate to this as a soundtrack to a movie. When you think about our use of music, it's not always at all a happy thing or a thing to rejoice over. Sometimes it's ominous. And a good composer can paint a story with music in a very amazing way. Often gives you clues to what's coming up. You know, if the music's a little ominous, you know, okay, this scene is not going to work out very well. See what's coming. And so I'm wondering here if Isaiah hasn't one-upped the movie industry by thousands of years ahead, depicting this battle as punctuated by the sounds of instruments. Every stroke comes with the sound of the tambourine and the lyre. Don't know, but that's kind of where I ended up there. For Tophet is ordained of old, yea, for the king it is prepared. He hath made it deep and large. The pile thereof is fire and much wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of brimstone, doth kindle it. Okay, so the word tophet means a place of burning, a reference to the Valley of Hinnom in Jerusalem. And so what Isaiah is suggesting here is that this rushing horde of Assyrians are rushing to their own funeral pyre, as it were. They're going to be annihilated themselves, as it were, by the breath of the Lord as he kindles it. Okay, so what has generated all of Isaiah's energy here in this graphic depiction of God's judgment both through and against the Assyrians? Well, there's an interesting passage in 2 Kings that I want to go to that I think captures for us the energy behind all this. And so it talks here about Hosea and how he, who was the king during this part of Isaiah's life, how he clave to the Lord, and the Lord prospered him. But it says here in verse 9, it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, king of Elah, king of Israel, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. So here's the picture. Samaria is to the north, and the Assyrians are campaigning against this part of the world. They come to Samaria first and besiege it. Shalmaneser is the Assyrian king. And at the end of 3 years, they took it, even in the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. Now, if you're following the numbers here, in verse 9, that this started in the fourth year of Hezekiah, and verse 10 says, at the end of 3 years, which was the sixth year of Hezekiah, you might think at first that they're using new math here, because that doesn't quite work. But the fact is, the expression at the end of 3 years doesn't mean what it means to us. It is more like after the second. So in the third year, or that is to say, toward the third year, is when it happened. It was still in, if you're going to add to Hezekiah's reign to figure out which reign of his it was in, you just add two. But hey, we're familiar with numbers being expressed in odd ways in ancient times. But it wasn't that they couldn't add. It's just that in English, the expression at the end of 3 years is not particularly ambiguous. It's like, okay, at the end of 3 years, you're going to have to add three to get to what it was. But that's where the breakdown is. the king of Assyria took it. Oh, notice here also in verse 10, it says, and at the end of 3 years, they took it. You might expect it to say he took it, Shalmaneser the king. The fact of the matter is that Shalmaneser died before the siege was up, and his successor Sargon is actually the one who took it. And there's a lot of discussion about the fact that the Hebrew uses this plural pronoun whenever you expect a singular, really, apparently to allow that unstated fact here to come through, that it was actually the next person. they. Anyway, they got took. Anyway, and literally they got taken and displaced and moved. The Assyrians figured out that if you want to control people, it's a lot easier if you get them out of their familiar surroundings, out of their environment. They have typically an advantage over you if they are in their home country, their home turf. They know the ways and the means to get around. They know the resources, and they're much more liable to form a rebellion against you. After all, you know, if you're from Assyria and you're trying to rule something that's 1,000 miles away, that's a pretty good task. Because you can't fly there like we can now. There's no helicopters or airplanes. And so your threats against them are all that you have to ensure that they obey you. Well, the Assyrian kings came up with another plan. We'd just move them. Move them closer to us, put them in unfamiliar surroundings, and they're going to be much less likely, less able to carry out rebellion. And so it says here that the king of Assyria did carry them away, put them in Halal and in harbor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. So a long ways away. Because they obeyed not the voice of the Lord their God, but transgressed his covenant, and all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and would not hear them nor do them. Okay, so this was the prequel to what was going to be experienced by Jerusalem. Samaria got conquered. Now, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, so that would have been, what, 8 years later? Did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them? No, not all of them. There are some cases in the Bible where all doesn't mean all. Jerusalem wasn't taken, but most of the cities of Judah were besieged and taken. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, "I have offended. Return from me that thou puttest that which thou puttest on me, I will bear." Okay, so Hezekiah had rebelled against the king of Assyria. His father had paid tribute to Assyria. Hezekiah didn't, and so now the king of Assyria is at his front door, beating down the gate, at least of his neighboring city. And he's like, maybe that wasn't a good idea. And so he sends to him and says, "Look, I'll pay whatever you charge, whatever tribute you lay on me." And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Okay, how much money is that? Well, it's always challenging to make those conversions from ancient times to modern. But somewhere between 50 million and 500 million, depending on various factors. It was a lot of money. Now, one thing that's interesting when you're trying to go back in ancient times and compare monies is that various things have happened in history that have changed the relative value of things like silver and gold. Apparently, there were some times in the ancient world where silver was actually more valued than gold. Seems to be some Egyptian inscriptions that suggest that. In general, gold is more valuable than silver because it is more rare. There's much more silver and mineable silver on the earth than there is gold. And that whole principle of supply and demand works for precious metals as it does most things. And so that's one factor. And then, of course, the other thing about gold is it doesn't tarnish like silver does. I remember a long time ago recognizing that silverware isn't really all that good an idea because it turns black if you don't keep it either in use or polished. And so it's still quite valuable. But one of the things, interestingly, that has changed that ratio or that relative value has been the Spanish and their silver mines in the New World. They mined so much silver out of the Americas that it depressed the value for some time. So supply and demand, right? So then it makes it more difficult to go back thousands of years ago and try to figure out what a value it was been. But you can tell by these numbers that silver was more plentiful than gold, right? Because he wanted a lot more of it because it was possible. You know, you can say, well, I want 600 or 300 talents of gold. Well, that's fine, but if it's something that couldn't possibly be paid, what's the point? You know, you can't get blood out of a turnip, last I checked. He recognized, yeah, this is something I can get out of him. But it wasn't easy. Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. That would be a bitter pill, wouldn't it? But in spite of this, and verifying the treachery of the Assyrians, after King Sennacherib had said, pay me this much money, he sent his army anyway. So he didn't take gold for an answer. He took the gold and then sent his army. Well, to start with, he sent emissaries. He sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish, where they were a part of the siege, to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they were come up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the Fuller's Field. You know, out there by the Fuller's Field. I had a guy the other day that started giving me directions, and he says, oh, that's not there anymore. So don't give your directions on landmarks that have disappeared, right? So these are things that are sometimes difficult for us to locate now. But anyway, at the time of this writing, this identified it precisely. And when these guys from Assyria had called to the king, there came out to them Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder. And Rabshakeh said unto them, speak ye now to Hezekiah. Thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Thou sayest, but they are but vain words, I have counsel and strength for the war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? Now, behold, thou trustest upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh king of Egypt unto all that trust on him. And one thing that's interesting in this speech is the Assyrians knew what was going on. They had apparently good intelligence. And we'll see not only did they have intelligence about Judah's alliance with Egypt, but they have, if you will, dirt on Hosea I'm sorry, Hezekiah, that they think will be influential against him. So this whole process of dirty dealing in the public arena is not new, is it? It goes way back. And it is sometimes so powerful to know the secrets of your enemies. So he says, who are you trusting in? Well, you're trusting in Egypt. That's who you're trusting in. And they're like a, first of all, he slanders them. You normally lean on a staff, but he says, this staff is but a bruised reed. So bruised, like if you take a, if you take a herbaceous plant that is pretty stout, normally, and you take and bruise it, right? You take and break, not break it, but if you take your hand and go like this against it, it'll just fall over, right, after that, because it's lost its strength. So he says, this thing that you're considering a staff is nothing but a bruised reed. Furthermore, it's sharp on the end, and if you lean on it, it'll go into your hand instead of support you. So loaded with sarcasm and slander. And so then he considers the other options. But if you say unto me, we trust in Jehovah, our God. And get this. Is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away? Okay, so one thing about this period of history is that even though the temple was at Jerusalem, Jehovah at times was worshipped in other places in Palestine. There was, of course, a strong movement by the priesthood to centralize all worship in Jerusalem, but that wasn't the case. And one thing that Hezekiah, I keep wanting to get Hosea in there, did at the beginning of his reign was to eliminate the high places, not just of other gods, but places where Jehovah might have been worshipped. The Assyrians knew this, okay? They had intelligence, and they said, you've been destroying the places where Jehovah's been worshipped. You're going to trust in him? Is he going to be happy with that, you think? So they were smart adversaries, weren't they? They knew how to try to get at the basis of what you're trusting in and undermine it. So he says, if you say that we trust in Jehovah, look, you've been working against him. Now, therefore, I pray thee, give pledges to my king, I'm sorry, my lord, the king of Assyria. Okay, and so now this is this is a slander. He's saying, basically, make a bet with the king of Assyria. He says, I will deliver thee 2,000 horses, if you are able, on your part, to put riders on them. How then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain, of the least of my master's servants, and put your trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? He's belittling the military capabilities of the Israelites. He says, I could give you 2,000 horses that you don't have, and if you were able to put people on them, which is unlikely, even then you would be no match for one captain of the least of my master's servants. Am I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? Okay, so here's, if none of these other arguments have worked, he says here, the Lord, Jehovah, said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. Okay, so he's claiming that furthermore, God is on, your God is on my side. And so I don't know if this indicates that the Assyrians had been reading Isaiah's prophecies, if they had heard about some of the things that had been prophesied against Israel. But this is quite a tactic to use in this process. And so you can imagine then that these ambassadors from Jerusalem were concerned. Furthermore, they said to him, speak, I pray thee, to thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and talk not with us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. Okay. So this is diplomacy. We're engaged here in negotiations, and we don't want this broadcast on Facebook where everybody else can see it and understand it. And the response is very crude. You can read it there for yourself in verse 27. He implies that as a result of this siege, you're going to be without food of any sort that is edible. And they're going to have the same fate, and why shouldn't they hear? And so in response, the Assyrians cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and said, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Okay, so they really missed the mark there, right? They start out by saying, Jehovah has sent us to destroy this land. But then they say, don't trust in Jehovah. I can just feel the anger of Isaiah in response to this kind of treacherous negotiation and slander. They say, hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present and come out to me. And then eat ye every man of his own vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of oil and olive oil and honey, that ye may live and not die. Hearken not unto Hezekiah when he persuadeth you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Okay, and then he further destroys himself by comparing God to the other gods of the other nations. He says, hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and of Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvim, Hinnah, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria out of mine hand? Who are they among all the gods of the countries that that have delivered their country out of mine hand, which the Lord doth that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of mine hand? But the people kept their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, saying, answer him not. So then the ambassadors came back and rent their clothes and told him the words of the Assyrians. Well, it goes on to tell us that Hezekiah went before God. He sent for Isaiah and says, here's what's going on, as though Isaiah didn't know. So in verse 6 then of the next chapter, Isaiah says, thus shall you say to your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words which thou hast heard, which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I will send a blast upon him, and he shall hear a rumor. and shall return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. And so the words of Isaiah. So then the Assyrians got word that the siege of Lachish was over, and they had moved on to another city, and so they returned to their king. So anyway, hopefully this gives you a little bit of the sense of the energy and dynamic that's behind the prophecies of Isaiah here when he thunders these words of judgment against the Assyrians and continues to admonish the Israelites to trust in the Lord. God is in control of all these things. God is, with a word, able to totally annihilate the Assyrians. And you should trust in him. And of course, the rest of that story goes on to tell how that the Assyrians then approached Jerusalem to besiege it. And instead of doing that, in verse 32 of chapter 19, therefore thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow here, there, nor come before it with shield, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose, this wasn't the ones that were smote that arose, when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt in Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of his God, that his sons smote him with the sword. And they escaped into the land of Armenia. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. Now, it's interesting. The archaeologists have uncovered the inscriptions in Nineveh, ancient Nineveh, that recorded Sennacherib's conquests on this particular campaign. And he tells about besieging Lachish, and there's pictures there in the in carvings of the city being besieged. And he mentions Hezekiah. He talks about caging him up like a bird and Hezekiah paying him tribute. But he doesn't say anything about what happened at Jerusalem. Just sort of passes over that. So we don't have confirmation from those that it happened just like it says here in Kings. But he didn't take the city, and he didn't want to talk about it. And in general, when ancient kings didn't want to talk about a given event, it's because it didn't go well for them. So it's quite interesting that we have that parallel account from a non-friendly source that confirms that something went wrong with his siege of Jerusalem. But in all this, Isaiah is frustrated by the lack of trust in Jehovah and intent on communicating that this is the only hope of Jerusalem, both now and always, is to trust in the Lord. Well, it's time for the bell. Thank you. thank you all for staying alert during this morning session. It's even harder to stay awake when there aren't more people here, isn't it? Isn't that odd? The energy of audience. But I think we're going to sing a congregational song at this time. So,
there's the wonder of sunset at evening. God loves me. Oh, the wonder of it all, the wonder of it all, just to think that God loves me. Oh, the wonder of it all, the wonder of it all, just to think that God springtime and harvest, the sky, the stars, the sun. But the wonder of wonders that thrills my soul is a wonder that's only